Hi, I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of January 4th, 2013. This week, many of us are doing a double take at our post-fiscal cliff paychecks.
I'm probably going to be missing at least $80 a month, which is, that's baby food and a lot of diapers right there. I'm going to have to come up with somewhere else.
What the payroll tax hike means for working Americans. Also, more people are bucking the tradition of working a full-time job.
So many freelancers many years ago, when they told their families what they did, they were considered slacker dudes or unemployed. And now they can hold their head up high and say, you know, this is what I do. And this is how I earn a living. And no, I can't pick up your dry cleaning.
And in a tight economy, some consumers chase after scarce products. But not just any rare commodity will do.
You know, so if you said, for example, there weren't many Yugos out there, and now there aren't, but that's not a motivating factor, because like, shoot, I don't want one of those anyway.
Those stories and more coming up on Marketplace Money from APM.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
By now, most of you have heard that this new year, 2013, will include a tax increase. And it's coming out of your first paycheck, so get ready. Back in 2010, payroll taxes that fund Social Security were cut by 2%. Now that cut has expired. And although this may not sound like a lot of money, that means that workers making $50,000 a year are going to be out about $1,000. So whether you make a lot or not so much, your take-home pay is going to shrink, at least a little. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein talks with taxpayers about how this change affects their wallets.
David Hanlos finds comfort in numbers.
It helps me make better decisions.
So the computer engineer in Omaha, Nebraska, crunched the numbers to find out what his paycheck's going to look like in 2013.
I'm thinking I'm probably going to be missing at least, you know, it's going to be at least $80 a month, which is, that's baby food and a lot of diapers right there. I'm going to have to come up with somewhere else.
Workers across the country will see an increase to the Social Security payroll tax because the two-year holiday is over. And Robertson Williams of the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center says the increase is coming fast.
That will hit the first paycheck you get in January. It'll be about 2 percentage points smaller than it otherwise would be.
Thanks to the fiscal cliff deal and other provisions that took effect January 1st, this year's tax code looks pretty different than last year's. There's the payroll tax, an increase to capital gains and income tax rates, and the elimination of certain deductions, too. But Williams says when you put it all together, you end up with a pretty equitable set of changes. For example, he says, if you make under $500,000, your after-tax income will go down 2%. But if you earn more than $1 million, it drops 8%.
It's a very progressive tax increase, hitting the wealthiest households the hardest.
The impact of the missing money, of course, depends on a person's situation. Carrie Coghill, a financial planner in Pittsburgh, says for her high-end clients, this increase isn't exactly a game changer.
I just don't think they're significant. They're more of a nuisance, I think, for a lot of people.
As someone who earns just above $400,000 a year, Coghill says that's certainly true for her. Ultimately, Coghill thinks she'll have to fork over an extra $6,000 and sacrifice things she can afford to lose.
It's those true discretionary items. It will be shoes and clothes.
Some middle-class families say this whole tax business won't have any impact on their spending. People like David Caraway, a teacher in San Antonio, and his wife.
I'm cheap. We're cheap.
Caraway explains most of the extra $2,300 they'll pay in taxes was just going to go into savings anyway. On second thought, Caraway says there may be one thing.
We do have a habit for exotic beer. You know, I guess my favorite microbrewery might suffer from, you know, the loss of the Caraway six-pack.
In some households, every penny matters, where an extra $20 a week in taxes makes it that much harder to make rent, fill the tank, or eat. David Hanlos in Nebraska isn't quite in that group, but with a young family, debt, and dreams of financial security, he's not thrilled to see his pay go down. But what really worries him is that this whole fiscal cliff thing, spending cuts and higher taxes, isn't over.
We can't just cut funding drastically to all sorts of programs out there. On the other hand, we can't just double everyone's taxes and hope that'll work out well.
Hanlos says as winter settles in, he'll be watching the newest round of fiscal fights, the debt ceiling and the like, nervously, wondering if he's going to have to crunch the numbers again. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
If you'd like to see how the new tax law will affect your paycheck, just go to our website, marketplace.org. In the few days we've had to adjust to the new post-fiscal cliff economy, many of us are thinking about how we'll make do with less. These days, even millionaires can feel uncertain of their financial future. So how do feelings of deprivation affect consumer behavior? A new study from New York University says that groups of consumers who feel the most deprived are also those most swayed by their emotions. Marketplace's Sally Herships has more.
To see one of the newest findings in marketing psychology in action, we need to take a look at two scarce items at very different locations. First, a pair of sneakers at a hip-hop concert in New York City.
What are you wearing tonight?
I have on some XO Fits by Reebok, custom-made.
Oh.
I love Reebok, and I think they love me too, but, you know.
Second, a vintage watch worth $40,000 at an office in Secaucus, New Jersey.
You know, I know that when I walk into a room, I work with plenty of wealthy people, they're not going to have these.
Both speakers you just heard, Ian Callender at the hip-hop concert and Aaron Cohen, the business consultant, are talking about how having items that are scarce makes them feel better about themselves. Callender says he has 300 pairs of sneakers. At first, he told me his special footwear wasn't really a material thing, but then I asked him how he felt when he put on a pair.
Well, I'm practically like everybody else, but when I wear my sneakers, I'm in that 1 percentile.
See, that's what I'm talking about. For you, it does make you feel better.
Then there's Aaron Cohen's reaction to wearing his Patek Philippe perpetual calendar watch. Cohen says when he wears it to meetings, his sleeves are rolled up. I asked him to demonstrate. Putting on his watch. All right, now how do you feel now that you're wearing your watch?
A bit silly, but no, I feel great, right? I mean, I'm wearing a white shirt, but what else sticks me apart? I mean, this is part of what makes me who I am.
Back in 2008, at the height of the financial crisis, NYU Stern School of Business professor Adam Alter wondered how consumers were responding to deprivation. He found out that when we feel deprived, we're more likely to prefer items that are scarce. But they have to be truly scarce. Even long lines for the latest iPhone won't create the effect.
So if it's not available because others already have it, the effect doesn't hold.
But when the scarcity effect does kick in, it hits rich and poor alike.
We're always looking to other people who are similar to us to work out what our standing is. Finances, what you earn, how much you have, these aren't objective measures. They're very difficult things to quantify. And so people look around and try to work out how well off they are.
Imagine you're rich, strolling down the street and feeling good. Then it's time for lunch at the yacht club. Now you're sitting next to another Richie Rich, and the gym on his yacht has a new sauna and a waterfall. All of a sudden, you don't feel so good.
Must be very painful.
Yeah, it sounds horrific, doesn't it?
Alter says this is the moment when consumers are vulnerable to buying scarce items. And the people who are most affected are the poor. For them, the feeling of deprivation tends to be chronic. As consumers, they're looking for pick-me-ups, and so they're more often drawn to scarce items, not always practical. But Alter says scarcity could be used as a tool for good. Take obesity. It disproportionately affects the poor. Marketers could use scarcity as a tool to promote healthy eating.
You mean like presenting a shortage of Brussels sprouts?
Presenting a shortage of Brussels sprouts. That's exactly the soundbite we'd be looking for.
Unfortunately, it's not that simple. That's according to Tim Calkins. He teaches marketing at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management.
Well, you know, for a product to work on scarcity, it has to be something that people want. You know, certainly my kids, I think, if they heard there was a shortage of spinach, they might be delighted by that news.
Right. That's not what marketers want.
Before scarcity can work to market a product, Calkin says it already needs to be a strong brand.
You know, so if you said, for example, there weren't many Yugos out there, and now there aren't, but that's not a motivating factor because, like, shoot, I don't want one of those anyway.
Next, there can't be too many substitutes, which brings us back to the coolness factor of sneakers. Everybody wears shoes, but only the 1%, like Ian Callender, can rock a custom pair of Reebok's XL Fits. In New York, and about to make myself scarce, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
As we just heard, many Americans will notice their paychecks are lighter this year, thanks to the payroll tax hike. Of course, unexpected financial curveballs come our way all the time, and we do what we can to make up for them. Maybe we go out to eat less, take fewer vacations, or pay down a mortgage. We work day after day, year after year, to get ready for a future when we hope we won't have to work. But retirement isn't quite as simple as it used to be. And all those fancy investment portfolios some people have, well, they could end up throwing a few curveballs of their own. Here's commentator Chris Farrell.
We've all gotten the message to save more for retirement. Problem is, our national conversation about planning for retirement is on the wrong track. It reflects too much Wall Street and not enough Main Street. With the rise of the 401k, Wall Street has convinced us that we need to be savvy investors to reach a comfortable retirement. We've been told that stocks offer the highest potential return, and that the central question of retirement planning is to figure out how much stock risk we can bear. That might be true for someone worth millions, but the typical worker nearing retirement has less than $100,000 in their 401k. As Alicia Minnell, head of the Center for Retirement Research, points out, most of us don't have enough money in the retirement till for high returns to count much. What does boost retirement income? Let's turn to Main Street for guidance. Your grandparents were spot on when they said, spend less. You may have rolled your eyes when they passed on that time-honored chestnut, but they were right. The reason we don't hear this from Wall Street is they don't make commissions pushing frugality. Main Street has also come to realize that most of us are going to need to work longer. I find these numbers convincing. If the typical worker starts socking away for retirement at age 25 rather than 45, she cuts her required savings rate for a decent retirement by about two-thirds. But don't worry if you're already in your 40s or older. Delaying retirement from age 62 to 70 also cuts the required savings rate by two-thirds. Look, as part of the 401k generation, we all need a well-diversified portfolio. But we should pay much more attention to our spending habits and our careers, and much less on our mix of financial assets.
Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell. Now it's time for your letters. A lot of us are just getting back to work after the holidays, but if we're going to be able to pay the bills for those gifts and vacations, we'd better get back in the swing of good money management. So we've invited Los Angeles Times consumer columnist David Lazarus to the program to remind us to get our fiscal houses in order. And it's so nice to welcome you to the show, David. Happy New Year.
And to you, Barbara.
I enjoyed your New Year's Day column about consumer-friendly resolutions you'd like to see businesses making in the coming year. Could you share one of them with us?
Well, God forbid I make resolutions on my own behalf, because then I'd have to live
much
up to them.
Much easier to do it this way.
Much easier to make resolutions for others. And I topped my list with a resolution on behalf of our friends in the cable and satellite industries to maybe put a little bit of their lobbying power, and they spend millions of dollars annually lobbying lawmakers, and try and get some legislation to undo those fat, expensive, bundled programming packages that the so-called broadcasters like Disney or Fox or whoever force down the throats of consumers. What do I mean by that? I mean, for example, if you're not a sports fan, you still got to pay for ESPN. If you don't speak Spanish, you might still be paying for Mundo Fox. You pay for dozens and dozens of channels that you might not use. In fact, according to Nielsen, the average TV viewer watches only 17 channels on a regular basis. That's approximately 100 channels that you're probably not watching at all. I can't think of another equivalent in the consumer world where consumers are required to buy a product that they don't want. For example, imagine if Hearst Corporation made you buy Redbook, a subscription to Redbook, if all you wanted was car and driver. It's the same deal.
Well, and I wouldn't be paid for all that time I spend cycling through all of those unused channels.
If you spend the time at all doing that.
Well, some things we can all wish for in 2013. Okay, are you ready to take a few calls?
Oh, locked and loaded.
Let's go to the phones. We have a listener online who's thinking ahead and hoping to pay off some debt in 2013. Emily is calling us from Seattle. Emily, welcome.
Hi, Barbara. Hi, David.
So what's your question for David?
I was wondering what your opinion about SmarterBucks, which is an online checking account that allows you to earn rewards that help pay down your student loans.
Oh, I like SmarterBucks, and I'm glad you brought it up. Now, for anyone who's playing along at home, SmarterBucks is a rewards program, kind of like you use your credit card and you get airline miles, for example. Same deal. In this case, SmarterBucks is offered by something called SmarterBank, which is brought to you by something called Simple Tuition. And the whole idea here is let's address student debt. And, you know, Barbara, right now we have more than $1 trillion in student debt, and that's more than Americans owe in credit card debt. So it's an astounding
Staggering.
Number. Yeah, exactly. And chipping away at that can be very, very difficult. So the beauty of SmarterBucks is every time you go out and use this SmarterBank card, a little bit of the money in the form of a reward goes towards a student loan of your choosing. Let me give you an example. If you have a $600 purchase, 50 cents of that will be earned on the first $100, and $5 will be earned on the remaining $500. That's a total of $5.50 in SmarterBucks that will be applied to your student loan. So let's say you've got a 10-year loan, $8,500, let's say. Let's say the interest rate, 6.8%, 7% or so. Well, if we're talking about an extra $10 a month repaid, that would eliminate the balance 16 months faster and result in $1,500 in savings than if you didn't have the SmarterBucks program. So you can see how it compounds and helps.
Well, that sounds really enticing. Emily, I understand you're unemployed right now and you're carrying some of these student loans. That's scary. How much are you in for?
I have about $35,000.
That's a big chunk. And she's not alone in that. A lot of people are carrying enormous sums in student loans. Let's face it, tuition costs have gone through the roof. Many, many public and private universities have had to raise their tuitions sky high to deal with the changing economic fortunes and all the stuff that's out there. It's expensive to get a higher education now.
Well, do you have any other suggestions, David, for what Emily can be doing?
Well, in any case, you want to be mindful of your student debt. And it's very important to remember as well, this is one of the few forms of debt that a bankruptcy filing will not erase. And so your student debt is going to be shackled to you virtually no matter how the economic and financial winds blow. So be mindful of this. You're not going to be able to escape it. Be proactive. Now, whether you need a helping hand like SmarterBucks, okay, fine, or whether you just simply need to have some sort of program whereby you are paying it down regularly as you would, say, a mortgage, that's the trick. I mean, in any handling of debt, the trick is stay on top of it and have a game plan.
Emily, I hope that helped you out.
It does. Thank you.
Thank you. And I wish you the best in finding a job early in this new year.
Thanks
for the call. Our next caller is Jeff in Montclair, New Jersey, and he has an interesting family situation involving his parents and their will. Hello, Jeff.
Hi. How are you all?
We're great. So your parents have named you executor of their will.
Yes. Well, they named me about 3 years ago, and for 2 years I just took the file of papers they sent me and put in a little file and then didn't look at it. And then I was listening to your show, and again, you recommended having tough conversations with elderly parents about the future and about money and about health care and that sort of thing. So I initiated the conversation, and it wasn't received well. I was, I was told, hey, what are you doing asking all these questions? And I said, well, I listened to the show Marketplace Money, and they said, well, okay, let's have a conversation. And so I said, well, in order for me to be a good executor, I need more information than just saying, you know, the key to the safe deposit box is in the box of tricks, which is kind of what they said. And so I asked, well, I need to know a few more details. And eventually my mother and I, because she's more the finance person, worked out an arrangement where she gave me the names and account numbers of every account they had. And I don't think they have a lot of money, but at least it would give me a place to start because it's in a lot of different places. But then that was about 6 months ago. When I went back for Christmas, I had a little argument with my father about something else, and he said, well, you know, we call you the vulture because you're just waiting for us to die to get our money. You're asking all these questions so you can get our stuff. And I thought, well, you know, my father is 83, and I thought, well, you know, maybe his age is playing a role in this, but I was really hurt by it, and it made me think, well, I'm probably not the only one, that it's not quite so easy to have these conversations, especially when maybe there's some senior issues, some maybe even paranoia about all the scams that target seniors, that maybe your own blood are doing the same thing to you. So I wanted to bring this back to you and ask you, what should I do?
Well, that's complicated, but good first move to blame it on us. So, David, what should Jeff do?
There's two prongs to this. First of all, there is the conversation. Points to you for initiating the conversation. You did exactly what you should be doing, not just as the executor, which gives you some skin in the game, but also as a good kid. As your parents get older, you want to make sure that they have laid the groundwork for all that is to come. It's a very important and mature conversation that we should all have. And I'm sorry that Dad didn't take it so well. I mean, that vulture line, that's rough. That's like something out of Dickens. And you know, that it was hurtful, and I think you were correct in kind of throwing up your force fields and going, whoa, where'd that come from? And, you know, I don't think it's Jeff's fault at all. I think it was good that he did this, and his dad clearly put a line in the sand and said, I don't like it. I think you're being invasive. And that's the other side of this, Jeff. You're the executor of the will. You're not his legal guardian. You do not have power of attorney. So the bottom line when it comes to their financial wishes is you have to back off. And even though that might seem reckless, even though it might seem irresponsible, and even though you yourself are doing the right thing, they kind of have their own life to live at this point, unless you're going to try and be proactive in declaring Dad incompetent about being able to handle this and trying to take steps. And a lot of families do that, and you might have to do it too if that's an issue. But it sounds like at this point, it's not. And so the key thing for you is to respect what he wants. If he thinks that you're a vulture circling his little nest egg, then you say, okay, Dad, fine. That nest egg is yours. You want to crack it. You want to scramble it. It's yours.
Maybe, though, Jeff, are there concerns about your parents' health or financial needs that they might have in the next few years? And maybe you could recouch your questions in terms of thinking ahead for their financial future rather than asking about the specific money in the account.
Yeah, there may come a day, and really all I want to know is what am I supposed to do, because it started so strangely where, and that's not actually the location of the key, but it was something as crazy as that, where, you know, when the time comes in the middle of all this grief, I'm supposed to look for this key and then figure out what to do, and I just wanted a little more prep than that. I don't even need to know how much is in each account, but I just need some help in knowing what I'm supposed to do.
Well, it sounds like Harry Potter. You got to find the key and do the thing. Jeff, do you at least have a copy of the will? I mean, have they given you that?
Yes.
Okay, so you know what you have to do. You might not have all of the details as to what is where and where the magic key is hidden, but the bottom line is you know their wishes, you know what they want done with their money. As the executor of the will, that's as much as you need to know at this point.
And I think that's so helpful about your show is that it's helped me in so many areas of my financial life. That's why I turn to you in this situation.
Oh, I hope that cleared something up for you, Jeff.
Thanks a lot.
And good luck with your parents.
Appreciate it.
Thanks for your call. Now we have Bill on the line from Allen, Texas, and he wants to run his retirement plan A by you, David. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how you doing?
Just great. So tell us about your dream for retirement.
My plan is to retire in the Philippines, and my thought process is multifold. First of all, I'm married to a Filipino, and that makes immigration to the Philippines a lot easier. But aside from that, you know, they've got a very nice exchange rate with the U.S. dollar, and also the cost of living there is quite reasonable. And so I've thought about this a good deal, and I look at the brochures, and I see the nice houses up in the mountains, and I'm feeling pretty good about the whole thing. But it occurs to me that, you know, I'm not the brightest light on the porch, and I'm probably missing something here. You know, if this was such, for example, if this were such a great idea, why isn't everybody doing it?
All right, well, you come to the right guy. I spent 12 years playing foreign correspondent, and among my various locales was Bangkok, which is not too far from the Philippines. So I get it. I get the attraction also of living overseas. There's a couple of things to keep in mind here, maybe more than a couple. If you're going to be retiring, first of all, you're counting primarily on your strong dollar having a lot of muscle overseas. More than likely it will, but you have to be mindful of the fact that the economic winds can shift and change, and it could be that the dollar will lose strength, and then suddenly you're caught unawares. So just keep that in mind. Other smaller things to think about are, like, you know, you're going to be getting older. How's the healthcare system over there compared to here? Are you going to be covered? For example, Medicare will not follow you overseas. Social Security will. You'll get those checks, but Medicare is not going to cover you overseas. So, you know, keep that in mind as well. And then the biggie is taxes. And you're probably going to be okay in the Philippines because the United States has tax treaties with a number of nations, including the Philippines, and that means you're probably going to be able to skirt double taxation. In other words, you're not going to get taxed twice on the same income. Now, if you are retiring there, but let's say your retirement income is based in the U.S., fine. You are going to have to pay U.S. taxes, but there is an exemption for people living overseas of about $91,000 or so that you can scratch off the list. So that's a good thing right there.
The $91,000, I kind of thought that was only income earned overseas. I didn't know that that exemption applied to income earned within the U.S.
Exactly. Now, that's your overseas income.
Oh, okay.
You will pay taxes on your income in the U.S.
Okay.
So let's say you are getting dividend income or interest income. You are still due to pay that. Now, if you have a certain very low threshold, you're not necessarily going to have to file, but almost all taxpayers under most circumstances will have to file a form every year, no matter what. Happily, the Philippine government is not going to be able to go after your U.S. income. Moreover, any income you get in the Philippines, let's say you're teaching English or doing something else, is just a way to kind of keep busy. Well, that's where that $91,000 exemption is going to fall. So it's probably going to be good. And the last thing I would say is simply Manila, maybe not my favorite place to retire, but there's a lot of nice places. Cebu, for example, in the Philippines, that could be very comfortable.
I hope that helps you out. And thanks for calling us today.
Thank you very much.
I hope you have a happy tropical retirement in the Philippines.
Take care.
You too. And that's all the time we have for listener letters this time. David Lazarus is the business and consumer columnist for the Los Angeles Times. David, thanks so much for joining us and for the lucid advice.
I'm off to Fiji.
Best of luck with that. And if you have a question about personal finance, we're always open. Next week, financial expert and certified public accountant Luis Barajas stops by the studio to answer more of your letters. So if you have questions or concerns about your money, say taxes, budgeting for the new year, saving for retirement, or anything else, let us know on Facebook, on Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank, or at our website, marketplace.org. Despite job insecurity and uncertain economic times, Generation X is aging into a sweet spot for advertisers. The 35 to 50-year-old crowd is still buying cars, homes, and other big-ticket items. But Gen Xers are famously frugal and suspicious of advertising. Independent producer Eric Malinsky looks at how established brands are trying to appeal to a very cynical generation.
When Chris Friedman walks into a Honda dealership, he comes prepared.
I look on a car comparison websites to see what other people say about them.
He posts reviews, he looks at the history of the cars, then he moves from the product to the salesman.
I look for dealerships that have fewer complaints lodged against them.
Friedman's behavior is actually pretty normal for a Gen Xer.
Generation X is a very skeptical consumer. Their characteristics is that they stalk product. They don't buy, they stalk.
Cam Marston studies demographic trends for his company Generation Insight. Marston says that Gen Xers are much more skeptical of brands and advertising than people in their 20s.
They're more eager to believe than eager to disbelieve. When the millennials have been burned, they don't set the world on fire to make sure everybody else knows about it like the Generation Xers do.
At the Honda dealership in Queens, an assertive customer like Chris Friedman doesn't put off the salesman.
I've got a price quote from a different dealer. I want to see if you can do better.
All right, let's find a place to sit.
Honda has even incorporated the savvy skepticism of Gen Xers into their commercials.
I wouldn't put too much value on cyber opinions. Factual research.
They'll give anybody a blog these days.
We'll see you later.
Michael Acavetti is a vice president at Honda. The car company has researched their customers as much as their customers have researched them.
I mean, this is a generation that is really the first that have, you know, worked to live rather than live to work. And they don't take themselves so seriously all the time. And they appreciate brands who recognize that and recognize their lifestyle and sensibilities and have that same type of attitude like Honda.
Many Honda commercials make fun of the fact that they're commercials. They rely on 80s music and characters like Ferris Bueller. In fact, when the hotel chain Hyatt did research on this new generation of business travelers, they discovered that Gen Xers want their hotels to be a casual, laid-back experience. So Hyatt created a sub-brand of boutique hotels called Andaz.
Andaz is the Hindi word for personal style.
Rachel Harrison is the director of communications for the Andaz Hotel in Lower Manhattan.
If you go into your friend's home, you're going to open up your computer and you're going to be able to log on. Very easy. This is what customers were asking for.
Checking into an Andaz hotel feels like walking into an Apple store. There is a front desk, but the concierge is usually not behind it. He's holding an iPad. He might check you in on the elevator or in your room. You can text him with questions and follow him on Twitter. Cam Marston imagines a day when every company will have to rebrand itself for a Gen X sensibility.
How about the cast of Friends sitting around discussing the life insurances that they've got, where their kids are now, and how important Viagra is to their relationships?
In New York City, I'm Eric Molinsky for Marketplace.
You're the founder of your company, also CEO, marketing director, project manager, social media strategist, and customer liaison. Oh, I forgot. On top of that, you're also the office manager and janitor. I'm describing, if you haven't guessed already, the average freelancer. People with full-time jobs think you don't really work, so you're always available to pick up their kids from school. Meanwhile, you haven't had a vacation in years, and you feel as if you are always on the job. To manage this challenge of managing yourself as an employee, you need more than a guide. You need a Bible. And that's exactly what my guest, Sarah Horowitz, has written. She is the founder of the advocacy group, the Freelancers Union, and author of the Freelancers Bible. Sarah, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I'm a freelancer myself, and one of the biggest challenges I find is that unlike a full-time job, you are all on your own all of the time. So what are your recommendations on how best to get and stay connected?
The most successful freelancers are the ones who build a network, and it really is about thinking about all your relationships. You are a 360-degree person, so from friends and family, from old colleagues, people that you meet at professional associations, just start to realize that this is your whole network for your whole self.
Even if you do that and keep in touch with that vast network, cash flow is such a problem, though. You have that feast or famine nature of freelancing. So what can freelancers do to even out the roller coaster ride?
What people do is they have worked out interesting and complicated relationships with other freelancers. So when you've taken on a lot of work, you can outsource to someone else. And when you don't have any work coming in, you can go back to those friends who you've outsourced to in the past. And let me just say, I think part of this also is that freelancers really are the new workforce, but a lot of the social legislation and other things just doesn't apply, like unemployment insurance.
Well, traditionally, people have thought of freelancing as a stepping stone to a full-time job, and that doesn't seem to be the case anymore. What do you tell your freelancers about that expectation and how to manage it?
Well, you know, I think so many people, after they've been laid off, after working traditionally, very much want to get a full-time job with benefits again. And what's really clear is that the amount of time between those jobs is just getting longer, if it will ever return. And I think that what people do is to start really having a bunch of different strategies, from having that long-term gig in place, from having that network, starting to build that up, and to just understand about being scrappy and realizing, you know what, you might need to go to Odesk or Elance or someplace and get a gig that's short-term that's just going to help you pay the rent. But I think that that's also where freelancers are just the most efficient economic units because they have to say, do I need to consume all these things? And that really does go right to the heart of anxiety, because that's where you get panicked. Will I be able to afford all those things I just bought?
What about dealing with the anxiety of the lifestyle of a freelancer?
One of the things that people who've been freelancing a while really learn is that it's not when you'll be unemployed, it's how much during the year, that there's just going to be this ebb and flow. And so you just don't get as panicked about it. And you start to build up all these what ifs, what if, what ifs. And that's when you start to outsource. And you need to be able to start segueing into all these different fields, but it requires planning. Again, that doesn't help you with the anxiety right away, but it gives you a plan about what you're going to do and how you're going to expand.
Well, when you get a bunch of freelancers together, one of the first topics they get into is it's so hard to get paid on time or get paid at all. So how should freelancers set up their billing to ensure that they're getting paid what they're worth and also getting paid promptly?
Number one is that people really need to have a contract. They can go to freelancersunion.org, and membership is free, and you can go to our contract creator and create that kind of contract. But really, again, this is another point where this is happening to the majority of workers will at some point be having a freelance experience. But again, we don't have a place for freelancers to go like the Department of Labor if you haven't been paid.
Well, for anyone who's listening who has a full-time job but is dreaming of starting a freelance career, what advice do you have about getting started?
Well, I think the first thing that you want to do is recognize that there are a bunch of different ways that you can start to freelance. You can look for a steady gig, and that could be a part-time job or just one big, reliable freelance job.
Well, before I let you go, I do want to ask, what is one thing that freelancers so often get wrong?
There's a thing called freelance pride, and they are major engines in the American economy. And what they do is so valuable and important. And I think that so many freelancers many years ago, when they told their families what they did, they were considered slacker dudes or unemployed. And now they can hold their head up high and say, you know, this is what I do, and this is how I earn a living. And no, I can't pick up your dry cleaning.
Sarah Horowitz is the founder of the advocacy group, the Freelancers Union, and author of the Freelancers Bible. Sarah, thank you for this.
Thank you.
In a struggling economy, odds are that the corporate trend of hiring contractors instead of salaried employees, which Sarah Horowitz just laid out for us, will only continue in the near future. Some analysts predict that by the end of the recession, as much as 50% of the workforce will be temporary or project-based. And some workers are doing just fine with this freelance lifestyle. Reporter Audrey Quinn spoke to two contract workers who are making the so-called gig economy work in their favor.
Freelancer Brianna Clem divides up her Brooklyn apartment by workplace potential.
So this is our living room, and this is where I often sit in this little leather chair in the corner.
Then there's the dining area.
If I really need to concentrate, I make myself sit at the table.
Then the back deck.
That always sounds like a good idea, but then the glare on your computer screen kind of ruins it.
Clem clearly likes having choices, but she didn't really get to choose to become a freelancer.
Okay, so I do technical project management for software.
She's a video game producer.
And I'd been doing that as a full-time employee for a long time.
Back in 2010, she got a job offer from Lego Toys. They wanted her 40 hours a week, but for a contract gig.
So I did that for a year, and then it became clear that they didn't really need me 40 hours a week anymore, but they could use me 30.
For extra hours, Clem picked up a production contract with another company. Then she took another one on. And soon enough, those gigs producing video games became her thing.
What I kind of specialize in is helping companies who don't necessarily have any need for full-time tech staff that does that. They're just kind of making a one-off.
She now balances up to 4 clients at a time. And on paper, she's actually making more money than she did in a regular job. And she only has to work about 30 hours a week.
But I am also paying a bunch more for health insurance. I don't have, you know, company matching a 401k, which I had before. I'm sure if you added up all of those benefits, I would not be making more money because the companies that I was working for full time before were paying for those things.
But she's really happy with how freelancing worked out.
It was by necessity that I moved to it, but I also now highly, highly prefer it and have been asked a number of times if I'd be interested in a full time job by places that I've worked and have turned that down.
Across the East River, in Lower Manhattan, Joe Sabia also works from home. But for him, freelancing was more of a destiny than a necessity. He's an online video editor, and he's always liked doing things a little creatively. Take, for example, how he let me into his third floor apartment.
Hey, Joe, it's Audrey Quinn. I'm outside.
Sabia tells me to look up.
Okay.
He's hanging out a window, holding a fishing pole.
He's got a fishing line here, and he's lowering me the key in a little packet. And there it is. Thanks. What number are you?
10. Sabia graduated college in 2008. He started out working for companies like HBO and MySpace. By 2008, he had a few viral videos under his belt and felt ready to go it alone.
I was only doing the thing that I knew I was good at the time, and that was just creating videos and hopefully finding people that would discover the videos and then say, hey, can you do that for me?
Since then, he's worked with AT&T, Tom's Shoes, and the Obama campaign. But he does keep one steady contract. He spends about three quarters of his time on a musical video series for YouTube's Next Lab.
I would say for freelancers, it is for your own sanity a great situation if you can have one client that, you know, you're always working with. Build on that, become friends with those people, show really good work, and you always have that in the can.
Sabia also does speaking gigs and brand consulting. He says it's helped to have as many skills as possible.
I would say try your best to diversify your talents. It's not enough in today's world just to be good at one thing. Have different talents, wear different hats, because that will just completely exponentially create a wider pool of people that can call you for services. And that's really important.
To hear about why more companies are calling on freelancers, I talked to Chris Bensky. He works in recruiting. I meet him farther uptown in another freelancing workspace, a cafe.
Let's move over here.
Bensky himself is joining the ranks of independent workers. His new startup, it helps people use social media to apply for jobs. I asked him why more and more people are going freelance.
So there's a couple of trends. One is that the jobs engine and the economy hasn't recovered from what happened in 2008.
So there's more college grads without full-time jobs.
The other thing that we're seeing are people are less inclined to take full-time employment, less inclined to take jobs with big Fortune 500 corporations, and more interested in working with small and medium businesses and working independently.
Bensky predicts the business environment will soon become better suited for freelancers.
I think it has to. I think it's inevitable. I just don't see a traditional employment relationship sustaining for, you know, the next 30 years.
He says those big issues, things like health care and retirement benefits, they'll soon be dealt with as more people become freelancers. In New York, I'm Audrey Quinn for Marketplace.
We have more information for freelancers, including some really helpful tips for setting your pay rate and finding work, at our website, marketplace.org. Whether you're a freelancer, contract worker, or full-time employee, one thing is certain. You want to get paid in full for the hours you put in. Thankfully, there are laws to ensure that. Still, every year, millions of Americans are victims of what some call wage theft. It's a practice in which a company fails to compensate workers for their time, shortchanges them on their benefits, or intentionally misclassifies employees in order to save money. And even though all of that is illegal, my guest says it's surprisingly common in the U.S. Kim Bobo is Executive Director of Interfaith Worker Justice and the author of Wage Theft in America. She joins us now. Welcome to the program, Kim.
Thank you, Barbara.
So what are the most common ways that companies arrange to pay workers less than their due?
Minimum wage is a problem. Recently, two workers came into our Arise Chicago Workers Center, and two Supermart workers had worked 60 hours a week and were both paid $330 a week. That's $5.50 an hour when the minimum wage in Illinois is $8.25. One worker was owed $24,000, another owed $17,000. So minimum wage and overtime violations are two of the most common ways that wage theft occurs. Another way is payroll fraud, when employers intentionally call people independent contractors when they are really employees. Now, if your boss, not you, declares you an independent contractor, you probably aren't one. Then there's also tip stealing. About 10% of tipped workers actually don't get their tips. Their employers just don't give them to them. This is really a crime wave in the nation, and it's a crime wave that we don't recognize.
You were just mentioning worker classification, and I wonder how much leeway there is in the law concerning that. Is it something that's in the eye of the beholder, that one person's independent contractor can be another's full-time worker?
Well, indeed, Barbara, there are some situations where it's a little confusing whether you could pay somebody as an independent contractor or not. But that's not the case for most of the misclassification that occurs in the country. A lot of misclassification occurs in the back of restaurants. So dishwashers and cooks are called independent contractors. The common sense rule is if you get up in the morning, you look at yourself in the mirror and you say, I'm going to business for myself. I'm working for myself today. Then you are indeed an independent contractor. If you get up in the morning and say, I'm going to work for somebody else, you're an employee. No matter what they call you, you are an employee.
Well, are you seeing this happening across the board or mostly with these hourly or low-wage workers?
It's a serious problem for both low-wage and middle-income workers. Indeed, probably the most egregious cases are against low-wage workers in a number of sectors. But you also have middle-income workers. I was talking to a worker the other day, and she said she's supposed to get overtime, but her employer says, we don't pay overtime. So if you work overtime, I'm not going to pay it. But they're given so much work, they can't possibly get it done in 40 hours, and they'll get fired if they work more than 40 hours. So they all just write down, we worked 40 hours. So again, it's common practice for firms to just say, we don't pay overtime, as if it's a personal choice. It's not a personal choice. There are clear laws on this.
Well, the Department of Labor is supposed to enforce fair labor practices. How well is it doing under the current administration?
Well, we have a really dedicated federal Department of Labor right now, and they're eager to do what they can. But there's 1,000 enforcement staff to protect 135 million workers in the nation. That's one enforcement staff person for every 135,000 workers. It's simply not enough. There are not enough cops on the job to protect us against wage theft.
Well, as we've seen most recently with the right to work legislation in Michigan, the power of unions has been waning in America in the last few decades. How much of a role then do unions play in solving the problem of wage theft? And what alternatives to the union model do you see?
Well, it used to be that unions played a huge role in fighting wage theft, and they still do today. If you work in a union place, you're probably not going to have wage theft because the union's going to make sure you don't have that. But when about 10% of workers now are represented by unions and efforts like the Michigan Right to Work law pass, it just creates an environment where workers aren't protected.
Well, what legal protection do workers have, ultimately, against this kind of mistreatment on the job?
Well, the laws are very clear. You have to pay people minimum wage. You have to pay overtime. Most workers are employees, not independent contractors. You have to give workers their tips. You have to give them their last paycheck. You can't deduct for weird deductions. I mean, the law is very clear. But if you have a law and you have no enforcement or inadequate enforcement, it doesn't work.
So for anyone listening who falls into this category, what is their first line of defense?
Well, first, they should understand what their rights are, and they can do that by going to a website called canmybossdothat.com. They can also call or place a claim with the Department of Labor. They should also educate people by looking at the Interfaith Worker Justice website, which has a slew of resources on wage theft and what you can do to stop it in your community.
Kim Bobo is Executive Director of Interfaith Worker Justice and author of the book Wage Theft in America. Kim, pleasure talking with you. Thanks.
Thank you, Barbara.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Do let us know what you think of the show at marketplace.org, or you can tell us on our Facebook page, and you can keep up with us on Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank. Next time, we dissect all those corporate fees that show up on your bank statement and phone and cable bills. You know, the ones with the mysterious names that you just blindly pay.
In some cases, you're getting gouged $100 a month. And when you get all done with it, I show that for the typical American family, it's several thousand dollars a year taken from you, a nickel, a dime, and sometimes $100 at a time.
Marketplace Money is produced this week by Devin Maverick Robbins with Lindsay Foster Thomas, Mary Doe, and Candace Manriquez. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yore. I'm Barbara Bogave. Have a great weekend.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.